Good evening. Poland outlaws abortion as protests sweep the nation. Trump brokers a deal with Sudan. What does it mean for Palestinians? A change not in Lebanon. Nigeria erupts. And sell your gun for an iPad in the Bronx. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, October 23rd, 2020. Police in Poland used pepper spray against hundreds of people protesting in Warsaw against a court ruling that almost completely bans abortions. An angry crowd confronted riot police near the Warsaw house of the leader of Poland's right-wing ruling party, Jarosław Kaczynski, a mass protester speaking through a translator.
I'm here because I think these are my fundamental rights to decide if I want to give birth to a child or not. PIS is taking away our civil rights. The worst part of it is that in case of unwanted pregnancy, we can deal with it somehow because we have means, we have support, we have family here in Warsaw. But it's about girls in smaller villages who can even lose their lives.
Protesters also marched in at least four other major cities in Poland. Although despite limits to mass protests due to the coronavirus, organizers planned to block streets in Gdansk. A funeral for women's rights was held in Lodz, and others joined candlelight vigils in other cities. The protests are happening at a time when COVID-19 has been surging in Poland. On Friday, the government announced restaurants and bars must close for 2 weeks and public gatherings would be limited to five people. Poland's constitutional tribunal had ruled abortion is illegal even if the fetus is impaired. Government supporter Kasia Godek.
Today, Poland is an example for Europe. It's an example for the world. Ladies and gentlemen, we are not stuck in the historical necessity which commands marching to the left and gradually increases the availability to murder people.
Each year, thousands of Polish women seeking abortions are forced to travel to neighboring countries. Surveys show that while society was split on fully legal abortion, only a small minority backed further tightening of the rules. And President Trump announced today an agreement to normalize relations between Sudan and Israel, a move denounced by Palestinians as a new stab in the back. The agreement was sealed in a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok.
On the phone, we have some terrific people, Chairman Abdel al-Burhan and Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok of Sudan, a beautiful part of the world, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I think you mostly know him. You perhaps heard of him somewhere. We have the very highly sophisticated press. I think they may have heard of him, of Israel. So I want to just congratulate all of you, the State of Israel and the Republic of Sudan, have agreed to make peace. This is for many, many years they've been at odds, to put it nicely, and to normalize their relations. This will be the third country where we're doing this, and we have many, many more coming. We have they're coming at us hot and heavy. In the coming weeks, they will meet to negotiate cooperation agreements. You saw that happen with UAE and Bahrain recently in agriculture, technology, aviation, migration and other critical areas. This historic deal comes just a few weeks after the groundbreaking agreement between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Israel and the and Bahrain. That was very historic. That was a great day, a very historic day. Bahrain and United Arab Emirates. 3 months ago, no one thought this would be possible. Even Bibi didn't know if this was going to be possible, Bibi, right? And it should have been done this way a long time ago. The Palestinians, by the way, if you ask about the Palestinians, they're wanting to do something. They've never seen anything like this. They're wanting to do something. I'm sure that will get done, too. So I'd like to congratulate everybody on the phone. And I don't know if you have interpreters or if you needed the interpreters for that. But if you do, you can go forward, interpreters, if you need them.
I am very pleased to speak to you, President Trump, and Prime Minister Netanyahu. This call is indeed an indication that a new chapter in our history of Sudan and the rest of the world has just begun. I would like to start with expressing my thanks to President Trump for taking the decision of rescinding the designation of Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. This decision, the rescission of this designation of Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism, will tremendously impact the economic situation in Sudan as it paves the road for Sudan's integration, as you put it rightly, into the global economy. More importantly, it will help Sudan restore its rightful place as a tolerant, peace-loving country, as a nation we have never sponsored for supporting terrorism.
Well, thank you very much. It was beautifully stated, and I appreciate it. Bibi, would you like to say something?
Trump added he expects the Palestinians and other nations, including Saudi Arabia, to also agree to closer ties with Israel in the coming months. Both President Trump, facing tough re-election odds, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, mired in a corruption scandal, are desperate for even the appearance of progress towards peace in the region. Palestinian human rights lawyer and solidarity activist Huwaida Araf says a deal with Sudan and earlier with the UAE and Bahrain are not supported by Palestinians suffering United States support for Israel's oppression.
Palestinian people are overwhelmingly opposed to this. There has been a global call from the Palestinian people for boycott, divestment, and sanctions from Israel because we recognize that Israel is able to do what it's doing. It is imprisoning the Palestinian people in Gaza and basically driving them to their knees. It's caused a deliberate humanitarian crisis in Gaza where the small enclave that's completely surrounded is unlivable with not enough water, electricity only about 4 hours a day, which devastates hospitals, the ability of Gaza to produce. They can't import or export anything without Israel's express agreement. People can't even seek medical aid. They can't leave this small area of land, and that's deliberately imposed by Israel. In the West Bank, it's only slightly better, but not much, because Israel continues to take their land to stifle their movement. You can't go from one town to another without passing through an Israeli checkpoint and being under the gun of an Israeli soldier, which can turn you back, even if you're going to school or to the hospital or to visit relatives. It's severe oppression, and Israel's able to do this because there are not international sanctions on Israel. And in this context, the Palestinian people have called on global civil society to boycott Israel. And amongst the people, unions, universities, organizations around the globe, there is this effort, just like there was against apartheid South Africa, to isolate Israel, to boycott Israel, and to divest from Israel until it abides with international law and respects human rights. And in that context, you're seeing this pressure on Arab states to actually normalize with Israel. So it's very much condemned by the Palestinian people. But again, the Palestinian people have been left out of the entire equation, which is one of the biggest tragedies of this. It's just devastating to the Palestinian hopes of freedom and liberation.
The Palestinian people following American politics, the American election, is there a feeling that Trump or Biden represent anything that's different for them?
Palestinian people very much follow American politics because it has a profound impact on their lives also. Palestinians know the United States has been the biggest supporter and enabler of Israel's colonization of Palestinian land. The sad thing is that there has not been much difference between a Democrat and Republican administrations in terms of allowing Israel to do what it wants and continuing diplomatic and financial support to Israel. The Obama administration increased the aid that the United States gives to Israel from, it used to be at about $3 billion per year in military aid. It upped that to $3.8 billion per year in U.S. tax dollars without any kind of preconditions or any kind of requirement that Israel does not use this money to oppress or to violate international law. And Trump has certainly continued that. Now, Biden has been a tad bit more critical, but he has also stated vehement opposition to conditioning U.S. aid to Israel on respect for international law. And that's inexcusable, really, because the United States likes to project itself as a defender of human rights, as a promoter of democracy around the world. But when it comes to Israel, we seem to give that country carte blanche to do whatever it wants, and we will not tie our aid to Israel's respect for international law. The United States seems willing to do it everywhere else, but when it comes to Israel, that's something that neither administration has been willing to talk about or to implement. And in that sense, the Palestinians, while they realize that Trump has been disastrous, I don't think hold out too much hope in a Biden administration.
Palestinian human rights lawyer Huwaida Araf. In the besieged Gaza Strip, as spokesman for the Palestinian group Hamas, a traditional ally of Sudan, told a Reuters news agency the decision was a step in the wrong direction. An analyst, Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, says while the U.S. has removed Sudan from its list of terrorism-supporting nations to the eventual benefit of Sudan's floundering economy, a deal with Israel remains out of reach.
There is no agreement yet between Sudan and Israel. There's an agreement between Sudan and the United States, and that has been discussed for quite some time now, rather publicly. There is an agreement that Sudan said they would now begin discussions about normalization of relations with Israel, but nothing has been determined yet. The sequence was that Sudan agreed to pay the United States $335 million to the survivors of 1998 bombings in Kenya and Tanzania that killed a number of U.S. diplomats and families, and the attack on the U.S. Coal in 2000. That was a longstanding point of contention between the U.S. and Sudan. When Sudan agreed to pay that, the U.S. then went ahead and allowed Sudan to be taken off the list of state sponsoring terrorism. So essentially, Sudan bought its way off the anti-terrorism list. The U.S. made clear that one of the other criteria for taking Sudan off the terrorism list was its willingness to discuss normalization with Israel. But that is a far from settled question. What we're dealing with in Sudan right now is a new government that came into office only about a year and a half ago after a 30-year reign of Omar al-Bashir. The new government came into office following what some people were calling the Arab Spring 2.0, the uprisings that took place, nonviolent uprisings demanding massive change in Sudan, in Algeria, and a couple of other countries. And one of the things that it means is that with the overthrow of a longstanding dictatorship and a popularly supported government now in Sudan, that government has to be at least a little bit accountable to popular support. And popular positions, popular opinion in Sudan does not support normalization of relations with Israel. What this means now is that there is the possibility of new talks with Israel, between Sudan and Israel, but it's a far cry from what President Trump claimed it was this afternoon when he said that there's now an agreement, there's now a peace agreement. It's not about peace, it's about Trump's election.
What does this mean for the Palestinians?
Just as was the case with the agreement between Israel and the UAE and then Israel and Bahrain, the Palestinians get what my grandmother used to say, bupkis, meaning nothing. This was not about ending Israeli oppression of Palestinians, either the occupation of the 67 territories or restoring the internationally guaranteed right of return for Palestinians. It wasn't about any of that. It was about allowing the United States to go forward in creating what it likes to think is going to be a whole new Middle East where all the governments make nice with Israel, and the U.S. can claim credit for that. 5 years ago, the United Nations said that in 5 years, meaning in 2020, Gaza would be uninhabitable. We're almost at the end of 2020 right now. Gaza is indeed uninhabitable, but there are 2 million Gazan Palestinians, living in the Gaza Strip, the majority of them children under the age of 18. And it is uninhabitable, but they are there anyway. And no one is taking that into account. We heard no mention of it in the exuberant announcements of this potential new agreement between Israel and the Sudan, just as we heard nothing about it in the announcements of the agreements with the UAE and Bahrain. Public opinion matters in the Sudan in a way that it does not matter in the UAE or Bahrain or even in Saudi Arabia. They managed to bring into office a government which they believe is supposed to be representing them. So that government in Khartoum is going to have to be a little bit more accountable to public opinion than his counterparts in the Arab Gulf states.
analyst Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Lebanese veteran politician Saad al-Hariri was named Prime Minister of Lebanon yesterday, a position he also held from 2016 until January of 2020, when protests forced him to resign. Al-Hariri's father, Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, was assassinated in 2005. A new government will also have to contend with a COVID-19 surge and the fallout of the August explosion at Beirut port that killed nearly 200 people and caused billions of dollars of damage. While negotiating Lebanon's fractured political landscape and alliance with Iran that's drawn the ire of the U.S. government, Lebanese American University professor Rania Masri is a political activist and member of the Citizens and a Slate Party. She reports for WBAI from Beirut.
Year anniversary of his resignation, he comes back reincarnated. It just reminds me of Albert Einstein, who says that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
The terrible tragedy of the explosion, how has Beirut been recovering, and how did that have anything, if it did have anything to do with Mr. Hariri coming back?
No. They're two separate things. We have not recovered in any way from the explosion. There are still hundreds of thousands of people that are destitute, that have been deprived of their homes because of the explosion. The government apparatus has only 2 months after the explosion actually begun assessing the damage, but has not compensated any individual or taken care of anyone, be it from a healthcare perspective, be it from an infrastructural perspective. So no, we have not recovered from the explosion. Let me add on top of that, of course, we're still battling the extreme consequences of a bankruptcy. So let us not forget that our currency has lost 70% of its value and that more than 50% of the population is considered poor. So not only do we have the explosion to take care of. In the midst of this, of course, the sectarian system, the sectarian leaders that are closed upon themselves have chosen to deny the tragedy that they have caused and have chosen to deny behaving with any kind of authority, be it political authority or even moral responsibility, and have chosen to bring back the individual that was partly responsible for the crisis that we have today. They really take a sense of denial to its maximum, and they are probably awaiting some French support and trying to figure out what the international and regional powers are going to do to support them. But their political system is crumbling, and it is only a matter of time before they recognize that themselves.
The pandemic, how is that affecting Lebanon right now?
The pandemic is surging, and the pandemic itself is quite healthy. We ourselves are quite sick. And when you add the pandemic to our bankruptcy, and so you have our public hospitals that are the ones that are supposed to be taking care of people with COVID-19, but our public hospitals are facing a dire lack of sufficient material, and many of our nurses and doctors in our public hospitals have not been paid for several months, again, because of the bankruptcy. Meanwhile, our private hospitals have chosen not to take care of individuals with COVID-19 and chosen only to have people who have private health insurance welcomed at the private hospitals. And again, more than 50% of the Lebanese population has no health insurance of any kind. And so, again, the pandemic is rising, and we do not have the healthcare infrastructure to take care of each other in the midst of this pandemic.
Do people in Lebanon follow U.S. politics to the extent they watched the debate last night?
No. I don't know anyone who watched the debate last night, but that doesn't mean that we're not following U.S. politics. There is a sense in the country among some that if Biden were to be elected president, that that would be a transformation in the region. I personally find that to be an idea based on illusion more than based on anything else. At most, Biden may lessen the sanctions on Iran, may lessen restrictions on Syria, and of course these would have repercussions on Lebanon, positive repercussions on Lebanon, but that is the most that we can expect because the foreign policy difference between Biden and Trump really is not that large, not at all.
What's the future in your mind for Lebanon right now?
The future is dim. We are still in the middle of the tunnel, but the light at the end of the tunnel will not be created by outside forces. The light at the end of the tunnel will be something that we, the people of this country, will have to create.
Lebanese American University professor Rania Masri is a political activist, a member of the Citizens and a Slate Party. She reports for WBAI from Beirut. And Libya's two main warring factions agreed to a ceasefire on Friday, raising hopes for an end to 2 years of bloody turmoil that have drawn in military forces from Russia, Turkey, and other regional powers. The two sides signed the agreement at the United Nations in Geneva at the end of a week-long meeting of delegates from the internationally recognized Government of National Accord, which is based in the capital Tripoli, and the self-styled Libyan National Army, led by Khalifa Haftar, and based in the country's east. The two sides agreed to a complete countrywide and permanent agreement with immediate effect, said Stephanie Williams, the United Nations acting special envoy, who was chairwoman of the most recent talks. She said it called for frontline forces to return to their bases and for the withdrawal of all foreign forces and mercenaries within 3 months, a process that would be monitored by the United Nations. And Nigeria's president announced 51 civilians were killed in unrest following days of peaceful protest over police abuses, and he blamed hooliganism for the violence while asserting security forces used extreme restraint. President Muhammadu Buhari also pleaded with protesters who seemed to heed the call for calm.
I therefore call on our youth to discontinue the street protests and constructively engage government in finding solutions. Your voice has been heard loud and clear, and we are responding. To our neighbors in particular, and members of the international community, many of whom have expressed concern about the ongoing development in Nigeria, we thank you and urge you all to seek to know all the facts available before taking a position or rushing to judgment and making hasty pronouncements.
Nigeria's president, Muhammadu Buhari. Weeks of protests in Nigeria against police brutality had taken a violent turn on Tuesday when security forces opened fire on thousands of protesters, including men, women, and children, who had staged a peaceful sit-in in Lekki Bridge, the town in Lagos. Videos of the shooting proliferated on social media showing scores injured and demonstrators trying to tend to each other's wounds while crying for help. WBAI's Rebecca Miles spoke to Michael Ulatsbusan, a radio host with Splash FM, a popular station in southwest Nigeria. She asked him to describe what's happening in Lagos.
It's a chaotic situation. Two or 3 days before the president eventually came out to speak to Nigerians. He told Nigerians that he has heard their demands and they are working on the demands of the people. And so as we speak now, Lagos and some other places where you had violence 4 or 5 days ago have calmed down. That is the present situation as we speak.
Are there still curfews in response to the shootings and the on Tuesday?
In Lagos has been relaxed a bit. I understand that the government is thinking of lifting the curfew finally.
Has the government claimed responsibility for what happened on Tuesday at Lekki Gate?
That is a very big issue that you raise now. First of all, the Lagos State Governor told the Lagosians the forces beyond his control were responsible for the attack and the shooting that happened in Lekki area in Lagos. They are not sure they are the ones who gave orders for the people to be attacked. And the president did not even mention this in his national broadcast yesterday. Nobody is claiming responsibility for it. Why would they want to apologize or to say sorry to anybody when they are still, you know, trying to play hide and seek with Nigerians? But what we know is that some people were attacked. Some people came to attack them. The lights were, you know, switched off at the Lekki toll gate. Those issues are still under investigation, according to the Nigerian government as well as the Lagos State government. So nobody, as we speak, has come out to claim responsibility for what happened there.
So Lagos is a city of approximately 20 million people with a median age of 18 and unemployment as high as 27%. But these protests have not just been in Lagos, they've been countrywide. And initially the demand was to disband the SARS unit, and the president agreed to that. Are the protests also about this larger issue which you bring up of extreme poverty, unemployment, and fallout from the coronavirus pandemic?
Oh, well, yes, of course. a lot of people are hungry and poor in Nigeria. As one of us, remember that Nigeria is said to be the, you know, the poverty capital of the world. So we cannot escape the poverty that has also been visited on the people on account of the coronavirus pandemic. Since March, when you've had, you know, lockdowns across the country, a lot of people have lost jobs. A lot of people have, you know, really, you know, slid into poverty. So the unrest that you have is partly, you know, on account of the, you know, poverty level that has risen in the recent times. I'm not sure whether the government will be able to solve these issues. Of course, you know, the public outcry has visited this matter, but a lot of people are still poor and hungry, and they are very angry against the elite. If you observe, they have been, you know, attacking elite, you know, businesses and formations, particularly in a country where you have some of the best paid parliamentarians and the worst paid people, as well as the police force. It is a time to rewrite some of the history of the country, to redress some of the injustices in town. And that's exactly what's going on now.
WBAI's Rebecca Miles spoke to Michael Ulatunbusen, radio host with Splash FM. Close to 400,000 Nigerians and their children live in the U.S., many in New York, and the unrest in Nigeria has triggered protests worldwide, including here in New York City. There are several rallies planned here in the city in support of Nigeria in coming days. Residents said they want to stand in solidarity with Nigerians and lend a hand wherever they can. And finally, and the Bronx District Attorney Darcell D. Clark is sponsoring a gun buyback this weekend with the help of the New York Yankees. The buyback comes after a threefold increase in shootings in the borough since last year. And that's some of the news for Friday, October 23rd, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.